Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia?
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns on our Solartopia theme song for the day. We're back with another hour of Solartopia, the Green Power and Wellness Show. Today we're joined by a wonderful guest. Her name is Winona Howder, a long time friend of mine. Winona, are you there?
With you, Harvey.
Oh, likewise, Winona, likewise. Listen, before we jump into your wonderful book, Foodopoly, and you've got the whole hour here, so I set it aside just for you, knowing what a great guest you'd be, and that we're going to hear everything about food from soup to nuts, as they say. I did want to jump in on something before we get into Foodopoly. As you know, we cover a lot of nuclear issues on this show, and I have just read a report. It's actually from February 18th, a week ago. I don't know how I missed it, but the number of thyroid abnormalities among children around Fukushima has up 44.2%. And, you know, we have people running around saying that the health effects of Fukushima, the fallout, aren't that important. That there's really, we even had George Monbiot, a global warming advocate, activist, writing that Fukushima convinced him to be in favor of nuclear power because allegedly the health impacts were so marginal. Well, I got to say, as a father of five children, a 44.2% abnormality in thyroids among children, and this is among 94,975 children. This is not a small sample. The abnormalities on that proportion are apocalyptic. They're horrifying because if this is happening in children, these kids will be affected all their lives. Thyroid is very vulnerable, causes lots of problems, especially among developing children. And if ever there was an indicator, a clear sign that nuclear power is not acceptable, it's this horrifying jump in thyroid abnormalities among children around Fukushima. Again, this is a sample of 94,975 children, showing 44.2% of these kids. That's about 40,000 children with thyroid abnormalities less than 2 years. I mean, the anniversary of the accident is March 11th, so this is less than 2 years after this accident. To show this kind of impact on the bodies of these kids is just catastrophic, and I hope that people will take this seriously and understand that this technology is absolutely unacceptable in any way, shape, or form. You know, we now have global warming activists talking about the miracles of a small reactor. The allegedly carbon-free nuclear power plants are not carbon-free, and the idea of pouring, well, the Tennessee Valley Authority is about to pour $500 million into technology for new small modular reactors. It's the same old stuff as too cheap to meter, and radiation is good for you, and nuclear power plants can't explode. So this really has to be stopped. And this report, I've posted this report, by the way, at nukefree.org, www.nukefree.org, if you want to take a look on this report from the Japanese government about the skyrocketing number of thyroid abnormalities among children around Fukushima. Okay, Winona, you want to kick in on that? You've been involved with nuclear for a long time.
Well, you know, that should have been front page news. That should have been on all the networks. I mean, it just continues to show where nuclear issues are concerned, where radiation is concerned, we just don't get the truth. And this old and dangerous technology is still being promoted, and it's pretty shocking.
Yes.
Numbers that you talk about.
Right.
So, really horrifying.
It is.
And so many people have forgotten about Fukushima already, and I think we just have to keep reminding people about what the implications are and the long-term implications, because we know the real fallout from Fukushima won't be seen for many years to come.
Exactly right. Since you mentioned the angle, you know, the reality that this doesn't get any coverage, I pulled this report off Russian television. You know, the RT actually publishes a lot of this stuff that the American and the Western European media won't touch. And you're absolutely right. This should have been front page news all over the world. It's a huge, you know, a lot of studies, a lot of health studies, and this will become relevant in your book, Foodopoly, also, Winona Howder. A lot of these studies that are done on health impacts involve very small samples. And, you know, many very small samples are considered significant in the epidemiological community. This is a study of almost 100,000 children, for God's sake. And, you know, with 40,000 children, more than 40,000 children showing thyroid abnormalities less than 2 years after this disaster, that is horrifying.
It really is. It's shocking. And it really shows the poor state of the media and communications in our nation.
Yep. It's terrible. Okay, we've had our moment here with nuclear, although we can come back to it, because Winona, you have a really very, very impressive and long-term career in the environmental movement, and I'm not going to I don't like it when a host gives the bio of a guest. Tell us, Winona, what you've done over the years, and then we're going to get into your Foodopoly book here from the New Press. But tell us, please, give us an idea of what you what brings you to this.
Well, I've been a grassroots activist since I was in high school in the 1960s around civil rights, and was involved in the anti-nuclear movement as a very young person, and did social service work for a few years before working for the Union of Concerned Scientists on energy issues. And then I worked for Citizen Action as the environmental director, working with the state offices around the country, and went on to Public Citizen to run the Critical Mass energy program. And, you know, I guess I would sum up my career as grassroots activist. You know, if we don't have grassroots action, it's going to be very difficult to save our democracy. And all of these issues, whether it's food or water or energy, they're so interrelated.
Okay, good. And now, you did do nuclear issues for Critical Mass with Ralph Nader, didn't you?
The energy issues, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I worked on nuclear issues and nuclear waste issues and a lot of oil-related issues, but for about almost 10 years.
And what exactly did you do? What was the focus of your work?
Well, at that time, we were fighting Yucca Mountain, trying to prevent a centralized nuclear waste dump from being built. And we were also working on federal energy policy. It was during those years that we had the Energy Policy Act in 1992, and then another one, I think, was that in 97 or 98? I get the dates mixed up. But trying to have some sanity in our energy policy. And also during those years, that was kind of the beginning of trying to relicense nuclear reactors, very dangerous and a bad long-term strategy for the future. So we worked on a lot of different nuclear and energy-related issues with local groups around the country and a lot of the activists like yourself who've been working on nuclear issues since the 1970s.
Right. And how do you evaluate the progress we've made in fighting these guys?
Well, you know, I think we have a new generation of activists, and we just need to make sure that the history of nuclear power and how dangerous it is something that these young people are aware of, because they are becoming adults in a time when climate change is one of the most important issues. And I sometimes fear that some people are easily persuaded that nuclear power could be a replacement for dangerous nuclear power. And we need to make clear that none of these conventional energy sources, whether it's natural gas that's fracked, nuclear power, or coal, none of these are a strategy that we should be pursuing for the future. And we should be putting all of our energy and resources into developing and investing in renewables and energy efficiency technologies. And, you know, we've had the technology for a long time. What we don't have is the political will, because of our political system where public policy is bought and paid for by these companies, and just in a really shameless way.
Yes, and you know, it keeps getting worse and worse in many ways. I mean, a lot of people who thought Obama was going to bring big changes, look at who he's just thought. Well, they've floated, I guess what you call trial balloons, about this guy, Muniz, is that his name?
Right.
From MIT to become the new Secretary of Energy, seems to have no inclination whatsoever towards solartopian renewable technologies. He's all about gas and nukes, apparently. And, you know, how did we come this far after this many years to wind up with a guy from the fossil nuclear industry going in to be Secretary of Energy? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's totally ridiculous. And, you know, I was never real surprised about Obama, because when I was a public citizen, he was a senator, and we tried to lobby him when he was first elected about the Energy Policy Act that was going to be passed during his tenure in Congress. And really, with Exelon and his state and probably a large contributor, he wasn't interested in hearing about the problems with conventional power or nuclear power. So it hasn't been too much of a surprise to me.
Well, it's a disappointment, let's put it that way. Of course, also on nukefree.org, we're circulating a petition opposing this guy's nomination as Secretary of Energy.
Yeah, it's really terrible, because as the director of MIT's Energy Initiative, he's working with the founding members, and those include Shell, Saudi Aramco, BP Technology Ventures, and he's been a big supporter of all of the conventional forms of energy production.
Right.
And so it's really a shame, a real shame, that this is who the Obama administration is, you know, likely to appoint.
Well, his name is Ernest Moniz, M-O-N-I-Z. The Nuclear Information Resource Service, NIRS.org, has a petition that you can link to from nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, which I edit. And, I mean, he's been listed as a proponent. The National Journal describes this guy as the proponent of good old-fashioned nuclear energy.
Yeah.
I mean, WTF here. I mean, there is no good nuclear energy. It's all old-fashioned, of course.
Right.
And to come this far after all these years, to have this guy in the White House stick us with a jerk like this, you know, who's a throwback to the 1950s, after, I mean, the one good thing that you seem to be, we seem to be able to say about Obama that was that he was a reasonable, in his first term, he was a reasonably solid proponent of renewables. Now, you know, Stephen Chu was a nuclear engineer and a scientist and all that stuff, but he certainly knew the renewable industry. And
right.
The Obama administration, while it did push nuclear somewhat, it was a solid advocate, I think, in its first 4 years of renewables. And now this guy, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think he supports renewables. I just think that he believes that renewables are a small portion of the energy mix, and he is even more supportive of the conventional technologies.
Right. Well, let's deal with one problem, Winona, since I have you. We'll get to Foodopoly in a moment. But and since you have such a great history, you're a great activist, and always have enjoyed dealing with you because you're so smart. We have a situation in the environmental movement where a significant portion of the movement of the people who are dealing with global warming are advocating the advancement of small modular reactors as some sort of alleged solution or partial solution for the global warming problem, claiming that nuclear power is carbon-free, which is utterly ridiculous. And I wonder, you know, your thoughts on this. I mean, Dr. James Hansen, who, you know, is one of the big heroes of the global warming movement, is actively advocating this stuff.
Well, you know, I just think that, well, Dr. Hansen is a climate scientist, and he certainly shouldn't be advising on moving towards nuclear power. I've heard his presentation on this, and I think that someone like Dr. Hansen has kind of given up on our democracy and thinks that's about the best you can get, that he has to promote something that is conventional and accepted by policy leaders. And so he has spoken out for nuclear. I mean, you know, I think we have a problem generally with some of the large mainstream environmental groups not actually going out and working at the grassroots level and trying to build political power. And so now we're at a place where they're very discouraged and they go for schemes that are just the best that they can imagine that you can get. And so there is a lot of negotiating backwards and accepting things, you know, not just nuclear power, but this new and dangerous technology of fracking. It's just, it's craziness. We need a little bit of vision. It's time that we need to fight for what we want, not the best we can get. And we need a whole new young generation to be inspired to do that, to begin replacing activists like you and I. I'm sure we'll be activists till the day we die, but we need a younger generation, too, to step up and have the long view, the history of what's happened, and to fight for the future.
Yeah, I agree. Now, of course, there's a very interesting generation gap between the fracking movement and the no-nukes movement, which I've noticed. I've spoken at anti-fracking rallies, and of course, they do a lot on the no-nukes rallies. And there's like a 30-year age difference between the fracking rallies.
It is.
It's really amazing. You know, go ahead.
No, I just think that it's because fracking is something that's going on in legislatures and is moving right now, while the nuclear power plants have been there. And we need to relate these two issues because they're the same issue. Because we need these activists to be informed about the problems with nuclear power, too. And I do think there's a generation gap. I mean, I see it all the time. Even my own really committed and wonderful staff at Food and Water Watch, you know, people don't have the memory of what happened. Why would they? They weren't there. They're not taught it in school. So we need to provide that information.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, they don't remember the Three Mile Island. You know, it's like, well, I teach history here. There's no effective difference. When I teach my students in college now, there's no effective difference in their mind between the Vietnam War and the Spanish-American War. I mean,
right, exactly.
It's like, well, they're all in the past and they have no memory of it. And so,
it's like when we were in school and that's how we felt about World War II, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, well, that was in the past. I mean, I don't know anything about it. So,
right.
But it is quite shocking and very, very disturbing to have people like James Hansen advocating small modular nuclear reactors as if, as if they're going to work. You know, I saw a TED Talk. A couple of young people were talking about these new generation of reactors, and they were going to magically eat up nuclear waste and be powered for the next 100 years by all the spent fuel out there. And they were going to neutralize the nuclear waste problem and give us carbon-free energy and be really, really cheap. And, and then they get a big applause, and it's like, is this a Disney movie? I mean, are people just don't remember too cheap to meter and nuclear reactors can't explode? And then you hear about Hanford and, the tanks leaking at Hanford. And these are radioactive wastes. I had Bob Alvarez on the show last week, the great expert on this. These are materials that are leaking at Hanford that were created as much as 70 years ago. And there's still nobody knows what to do with this stuff. They can't even analyze what it is. It's leaking toward the Columbia River. They can't stop it. They have 177 tanks out there, which is primitive 1950s technology. Well, 140 of them are 1950s technology that would not be usable today. And they have no idea what to do with this stuff 70 years later. And then people turn around and say, well, let's build these wonderful new reactors, and here's what they'll do, and we don't have any of them yet, but of course they're going to work. I mean, come on.
No, it's crazy.
It is
absolutely
crazy.
Crazy. I mean, and then you have people like, former environmentalists, and I say former, like those in the UK that are promoting nuclear power, people like Mark Linus and the former Greenpeace staffer Stephen Tyndale, who are now being spotted out by the industry and saying, oh, they made a mistake, that actually nuclear power is the answer to the future. Of course, I'm sure if we had access to their tax returns and how they're making their speaking fees today and where they're getting their money, that there would be a connection between their new insight into nuclear power and their new career out speaking about nuclear power.
Yeah, well, I call it now the Patrick Moore syndrome. Moore was he was with Greenpeace in the early days, and really way back when, early 1970s. He was there for a while. He claims to have been a founder. That's disputed, but, what the heck. And then he disappeared. He was not part of the environmental movement for decades. And then all of a sudden he resurfaces, and he's billing himself as a founder of Greenpeace, and he's suddenly promoting nuclear power as the greatest thing since sliced bread, turning up getting big honorariums from the nuclear industry, showing up on Dennis Miller and all these other places.
Right.
And why do you support nuclear power? Well, why did Willie Sutton rob banks? Because that's
right.
Where the money is. So I don't know. Of course, we're never right to, I guess, be careful ascribing motive. So, but we'll just say that that's the Patrick Moore syndrome. And I have met Patrick, and he's very personable. Come on. James Hansen is very disturbing. George Monbiot, I've read his stuff. He's pretty smart, but, he should know better. These people should know better. They're not doing their homework. And so when we turn up with I have five kids. You have kids. I mean, when you turn up with 40% of the children out of 100,000, almost 100,000 sampled with thyroid abnormalities, and these were kids under the age of 10, for God's sakes, at Fukushima, this is, what else do you need to hear,
Yeah, and I would put James Hansen in a completely different category than somebody like Patrick Moore. I think that Dr. Hansen is so concerned and so clearly sees the future of climate change that he is just, you know, grabbing at anything and hasn't looked at the issues with nuclear power. Just isn't familiar with them.
Yeah, and that to me is strikingly irresponsible for a guy on his level. And I must say, I mean, many, many years ago, I heard Buckminster Fuller speaking. I heard him speak for 3 hours in Boulder, and he back then was warning about nuclear power. I mean, he did his homework. He understood. I don't understand how a guy of James Hansen's stature can be so completely ill-informed. It's very disturbing. Go ahead.
Did you see how the Obama administration Department of Energy is trotting out recycling the weapons waste again, the radioactive material?
Yes, it's astounding. They want to, and I posted this at nukefree.org. Also, they want to allow the metals from the nuclear weapons and power industries to be used in consumer products. For God's sakes. I mean, you know, radioactive zippers and frying pans and children's toys. I mean, what is with these people?
Yeah. Well, this is what happens when you create a lot of waste and there's no place to deal to put it or to deal with it.
Yeah.
And it's a good reason to be against nuclear power.
It is. It is. It's amazing. We're talking with Winona Howder. I knew I shouldn't have raised the nuclear issue because we've eaten up half the show. Winona, you're just such a great activist and such a wonderful resource. So let's get into your book. It's from the New Press, which I love dearly. They published our book on the theft of the Ohio election and presidential campaign in 2004. Wonderful editors there. Tell us about your book. We will take a break shortly, and then we'll get into the substance of the book. But tell us about Foodopoly and how it evolved and what it's about.
Well, I've been working on food and farm policy for about the last 10 years. And one of the things that has become so striking to me is that we have this fabulous good food movement, but in many ways it's not very political. And we're at a very dangerous point with food policy, and we really need people to do more than vote with their fork and how they eat. We need people to vote with their vote and to get involved in these really important issues. And one of the defining issues of our times related to food is the consolidation of the industry and how few companies control food and farming. And so I really wanted to add these issues to the good food agenda, because what we end up hearing a lot is that it's all about farmers have caused this problem, they've lobbied food subsidies, and we hear all these shortcuts that don't get to the real crux of the problem and who really controls our food system.
And who is that? Who does control our food system?
We have four giant retail chains with Walmart at the top. Walmart's the most powerful of the companies involved in food. 1 out of 3 grocery dollars goes to Walmart.
Holy God.
The other three large chains are Kroger, Target, and Costco. So these enormous box stores have every influence on how the food system is shaped because they need such volume. Then we have 20 food processing companies with PepsiCo and Nestle, Kraft, Tyson, and the Brazilian meat company JBS being the top five. And so when consumers go into the grocery store, they think that there's enormous diversity in all these brands. But we basically have 20 companies that control most of the brands in the grocery store. And they have used their relationship with hired food scientists to develop food using fat, sugar, and salt that's addictive to people and making people fat and sick. They've spent billions of dollars on advertising. The average child sees just under 5,000 junk food ads a year. and they use the ingredients that are produced by agribusiness, the corn and the soy and the cottonseed and all of those things. And they have really benefited from the way that agriculture has changed, and it's changed dramatically since 1996 when the U.S. joined the World Trade Organization and became a member of trade agreements like NAFTA. And so I wrote in Foodopoly, it's kind of an encyclopedia of what's gone wrong with our food system, going back to the policies and the Depression, and then following through what happened until today.
Wow. Okay, well, that's a tremendous range of stuff to cover. We're going to take a short break here. You'll hear Dana Lyons of Cows with Guns fame, one of the great food-oriented YouTube videos of all time, and one of the great songs. And then we'll come back and we'll be talking with Winona Howder, author of Foodopoly from the New Press, discussing the power of the major corporations over our food supply and what that really, really means for how we eat. Okay, so we'll be back in a moment.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
Topia, the Rocky Top version from my good buddy Dana Lyons. Dana is the purveyor, the writer, the singer, the producer of one of the truly wonderful videos about food, Cows with Guns. It's become the kind of vegetarian anthem. I got to tell you real quickly, we're on with the wonderful Winona Howder, author of Foodopoly, published by the New Press, a really great book, and we're going to talk about it in depth. Over the break, I took a quick look at part of an interview done by Dan Rather with Ernest Moniz, the apparent designee of Barack Obama for Secretary of Energy. I got to say, Winona, we got to stop this guy. I mean, he's just sitting there talking about reestablishing the nuclear option. I mean, come on. After all these years, we got to... This guy could have been appointed by Bush, for Christ's sake. I want to give you the time to talk about your book here. As before the break, you were telling us about the domination of the food industry by a small number of corporations, and the staggering fact that 33% of the American grocery dollar goes to Walmart. My God.
That's right. Isn't that unbelievable?
And
what's really shocking is that the Walmart heirs have as much wealth as the 40% bottom Americans. And so what they do is they basically suck all of the profit out of the food chain. In fact, they do this with every industry, but it's especially dramatic with food. And it's not just the unprecedented amount of power that they have because of their market share, it's the way that they continually put pressure on suppliers to cut costs. This is even having an effect on the organics industry, as suppliers are being forced to continue to cut the price of their products. And I think that Walmart's ability to do this is the very specific ways that it does business. It has this logistics and distribution model that is very different than other food retailers, and its logistical operations are run primarily through shifting the costs and responsibilities to its suppliers. And that means that anybody who sells to Walmart has to adopt their supply chain management, their data sharing programs. They have to manage their own inventory, even on store shelves. And it's the first company that brought high-tech information management and demanded that anybody who sells to them has to use it. And, you know, even for these giant companies like Pepsi or Nestle or Kraft, Walmart is their number one customer. In fact, Walmart buys about 1 billion pounds of beef every year. So they exercise all of this control over the design of the products, how they're packaged. Their contracts are non-negotiable. And they just have an enormous amount of power over all of the policies related to food, along with these giant food processors and the grain traders like Cargill and other types of ingredient processors like ConAgra. These companies have so much power that they step in to any federal policy debate, whether it's about labeling genetically engineered food or what pesticides we're exposed to. And they use their enormous political power to really dictate what gets done. And so from our point of view at Food and Water Watch, they've gotten too big to fail. And we need something to be done related to antitrust law. And it's not just in the food industry. It's every single industry in this country is about one or two giant companies controlling the products and the policies around the products. And, you know, I think we can go back to the Reagan administration to see where this violation of antitrust law really began. And during the process of writing Foodopoly, I had the opportunity to interview Michael Perchuk, who was the commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission at that time. And he told me that when Reagan's appointee came into the agency, a man named James Miller, a real right-wing ideologue, he cut the budget, cut out whole departments. He made policies that had been against the law, things like allowing competitors to merge, made that agency policy to allow that. And they narrowed the definition of what an antitrust violation is. So we have all of these companies that have all of these profits and all of the ability to buy public policy. And it's literally poisoning us and poisoning our environment.
Well, tell us how. Tell us, first, let's deal with food itself. Okay. Sugar, fat, oil.
It's both the kind of food that is being sold. So Americans spend about 90% of their food dollars, their budget, on processed food. And processed food is related to almost any of the adverse health effects that we see, from diabetes to cancer, eating a diet of fat, sugar, and salt that's nutrient poor and rich in calories, has also led to an epidemic of obesity. But it's also the way that the food is produced, so the pesticides and the herbicides, and the move towards genetically engineered food. And right now we're in a real battle over genetic engineering of foods. Since the 1990s, most of commodity crops like corn and soy are genetically engineered. But now we're beginning to see the things that are actually ending up on your dinner plate, like sweet corn being genetically engineered. And unfortunately, the Obama administration has allowed more genetically engineered products to come into the marketplace than Bush did, than any other president has. So one of the battles going on right now is over genetically engineered salmon. There has been such a public outcry over the last 2 years about this that the FDA has held back on legalizing it, although we know they have every intention of doing so. We've been urging people to comment to the FDA. You can go to our website at foodandwaterwatch.org to place a comment. They've just extended the comment period another 60 days. And this is this genetic engineering is a problem for many reasons. Well, first, it gives power to companies, corporations over the patented life. So seeds and this genetically engineered fish would actually it could outcompete natural wild salmon if it ever got loose. It isn't as healthy an option for consumers. Many people are allergic to the protein when it's been genetically engineered, and what we've seen with the salmon is they've spliced a gene from an eel with a salmon so that it would grow faster. The research that they did was not done by our federal FDA, Federal Food and Drug Administration. It was actually done by the industry, and their research is very poor. They had very small data sets. They culled any fish that looked different or odd. Their data sets had six fish in. They relied on three studies the FDA did in their initial analysis. Two of these studies weren't peer-reviewed, and one was 20 years old. And the industry is just trying to push ahead with this genetically engineered fish, even though the company that is behind it, Aqua Bounty, was on the verge of bankruptcy. But because this is the first cloned animal, or transgenic animal, the biotech industry has helped bail out the parent company that has is raising these eggs. So it's something that everybody should be concerned about.
It's an endless nightmare.
It is an endless nightmare.
So before we go too far afield, you know, we have a monopolized food industry. We have really bad food. We have genetically modified food. We have chemicals. And I've done a lot of research on aspartame, which, is a additive to soft drinks, which was perpetrated by Donald Rumsfeld. What's the solution? What are you advocating?
Well, the solution is that we need the good food movement, all the people who are really excited about local food, to get involved politically. Because, well, the local food movement is wonderful. I mean, I have a farm myself that my husband runs. It's great for the farmer, great for the consumer. But we want a food system that works for everybody, that produces safe and affordable, good food for our entire population. And that means that we need people to get involved in these issues. So there are a number of ways that people can get involved. First, there is an enormous movement across this country around getting genetically engineered food labeled. 30 different states have pending legislation or an initiative or activists working to strategize about how to pass labeling legislation so that a few states do it and so that the federal government is forced to do it. This year, there will be a farm bill debated. The farm bill is really a food bill because we have less than a million farmers left, but all 300 million Americans eat every day. And the farm bill is a 1,000-page piece of legislation that has everything to do with the details of how our food is produced. And we need people to be aware of that and to get involved in trying to force their elected official during the process of debating this lengthy piece of legislation to do the right thing on the different titles. And so we're asking people to get involved. And at Food and Water Watch, we give people avenues to get involved. We explain what's going on in each of the committees and how people can get involved in trying to impact these decisions. And, you know, we need people in in their own communities to begin building the political power that then translates into power at the state and power at the federal government. So people at the city or county level can pass a resolution about one of these important issues, and that can then serve to educate people. And, you know, that's what a grassroots movement is. Starts at the local level, and then eventually it gains so much momentum that you can do something politically. And I think that fixing our food system can help begin to fix our broken democracy, because we all know our democracy is broken. I mean, you just look at how the biotech industry has bought public policy. They, over 10 years, spent $572 million, have 100 lobby shops, hired 13 former members of Congress and 100 former staffers in the White House and Congress. And that has perverted public policy. We need an organized voting bloc, lots of people to get involved, to be a countervailing force to that kind of misbehavior. And, you know, all of these issues are related. So whether you're driven by food issues or doing something about climate change or about the nuclear industry, it's all about building political power. And we need to do it. We have to do it now. And we have to try to save what's left of our democracy so that we can create a sustainable future for our children. And I think that food and food activism can play a part in this, because it's one of those issues that's really grabbing people now. You know, it grabs you right in the gut, right?
Yeah.
And you deal with it every day, and I think it's a way to politicize people. And that's really why I wrote Foodopoly, to kind of break down the issues, talk about each of the problems, and then what needs to be done to begin addressing some of these complex issues.
Well, your fight against genetically modified food, of course, is very important. Your fight for organics is also very important. There's a lot of discussion these days about vegetarianism and veganism. How does that play into all this?
Well, you know, I think that the meat industry is a unethical and out-of-control industry, and that many people see factory farming as something that they don't want to support, and so there's a growing movement to not eat dairy or meat products. You know, I think that's a personal choice. And I certainly think that cutting all factory farmed meat and dairy products out of your diet will both protect your health, and it's also a good thing to do to not support this industry. The meat industry is really creating major health problems. For instance, the use of antibiotics, because the industry raises animals in such tight quarters, like 300, 400 chickens in a warehouse with less than a square foot to turn around in. The animals so crammed together that the only way they can survive is to give them low doses of antibiotics. And by the way, they also often feed chickens arsenic to give meat that nice rosy color. But the overuse of antibiotics is one of the major drivers of antibiotic resistance. We're literally overusing these life-saving drugs that have changed civilization, because people don't die from infections, and we're allowing the meat industry to waste them away by using them to produce animals under these horrific circumstances. And, you know, I think if most Americans knew how the animals that they eat were raised, they wouldn't go to the grocery store and buy this stuff. If they knew that chicken, that the industry, that companies like Tyson want to slaughter these birds, they're now trying to get what has been a pilot program allowing 200 birds per minute to be slaughtered. And they want to use this across the board in the industry. Well, you can imagine what happens when you're slaughtering 200 birds a minute. The line slaughter line, it goes so that all of that fecal matter ends up on the poultry, and then to deal with the bacteria, the industry dips it in chemical solutions like trisodium phosphate and chlorine. So I don't think people want to eat fecal matter, even if the bacteria is dead.
Yes, and you know, the waste that's produced by these concentrated animal feeding operations, these CAFOs, is apocalyptic. I mean, here in Ohio, we have pig farms and chicken farms especially where biblical plagues of flies and massive lakes and lagoons of manure are just destroying our environment. It's really horrifying.
It is horrifying, and the fact that the EPA is not doing anything about this situation is really horrific. And under the Obama administration, we had so many hopes that they would begin a stricter permitting program. But you know what their solution is? And some environmental groups are signing on to this. They want to do a cap-and-trade program for water pollution. So, for instance, on the eastern shore of Maryland and Virginia, they want to let the chicken factories, they have a plan in place to reduce pollution. Nobody has to verify the plan. And then they will establish credits based on these plans that can be bundled and sold to power plants and waste treatment facilities that don't want to get their permits. And this is the Obama administration and some of these weak-kneed environmental groups' idea of how they're going to solve the problems of waste from factory farming. And we're going to see this across the nation if we don't stop it. Food and Water Watch has sued on that. We've sued the EPA over this.
Well, I view meat production as the nuclear power of the food industry. I mean, you know, I actually became a vegetarian in 1970, although I still eat fish. Which I stopped after Fukushima. I've picked it up a bit, but if you can't eat farm-raised fish because of the chemicals, and you can't eat wild-caught fish because of Fukushima, you're kind of
left. Doesn't leave much choice, does it?
No, you're pretty much done with the fish industry. But Winona, your fantastic book is Foodopoly. I'm going to have you back to talk to you more about this because, you know, food obviously is an issue that touches everybody, and we have an epidemic of obesity in this country, of diabetes, food-related ailments. You know, a lot of it has to do with the addictive chemicals that are put into our food, and especially into our soft drinks. I did a piece for a scientific journal called Hustler Magazine about aspartame, which is just one of the ultimate poisons. I mean, talk about heroin, cocaine, and crystal meth. I mean, aspartame towers over all of them as an anti-life agent. And
well, did you see that they want to now not label for children's drinks? Drinks that have aspartame in, they want to promote these in schools because of the obesity epidemic, but they're not going to label it with the information about the aspartame.
Unbelievable. Well,
yeah.
Unfortunately, I hear the wonderful Pete Seeger beckoning us onward. We've flown through another hour of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Next week, we're going to talk about pot and hemp again. Two of my favorite topics, but Winona Howder, your wonderful book, Foodopoly from the New Press, thank you for talking about it with us, and we will have you back to talk more. Thanks so much,
Harvey. It's been a great
time. Anytime. We'll see you all next week on the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Thanks for listening in. We will be talking about medical and recreational and industrial cannabis. Talk to you then.
Don't you know we're gonna have